Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
Number one thing is relationship. And when we first started Vamos, we picked two of our community partners that we already had established relationships with. And they were two African-American churches in the east side of Austin, in the east side of Austin. And we already had partnerships with them through the Amen program. And we already had some of our students placed at their site for their clinical rotations. So I think that relationship over time really helped us to get in the door saying, hey, may we come and partner with you to vaccinate your congregation. So relationship building is huge when you think about trust.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I am your host, Ike Evans, and today I'm delighted to bring you episode 113, Vaccine Equity and Trust.
When we talk about well-being, for me, it's the person's ability to thrive.
Having their basic needs met, as well as having community and connection.
I think looking at an individual or a community in its entirety.
These are the moments where it's not only about celebrating, but it's about connecting with people and connecting with the community around you.
Well-being is when you are feeling kind of your best, and best, I think, is a moving target.
And supporting one another, continually talking to one another, sharing our resources, a community, that golden thread.
As of this recording, an astounding 230 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been administered to just under 143 million Americans. And a full 98 million Americans are now fully vaccinated, according to the CDC. This is both a staggering achievement and a turning point. We will soon be at a point where virtually everyone who wants the vaccine will be able to get it. But then what? News reports are chronicling a slowdown in vaccine appointments across the nation. The number of daily doses administered is down from a peak of 4.6 million on April 10th to about 3 million today. By now, most of those who have the access, the technological savvy, the resources, and the eagerness to find shots have gotten them. But as fewer people sign up to get their shots, a new narrative has become dominant. It's because of hesitancy, or too many people not wanting the vaccine, that vaccination rates have plateaued. As a catch-all term, vaccine hesitancy is all the rage. But does it adequately explain what's going on? By focusing so much on the hesitancy of individuals, do we risk losing sight of more fundamental problems of access, equity, and trust? Here with us to help hash this out is an expert whose work straddles the line between medicine and community outreach, and for whom this question of vaccine hesitancy versus equity is of prime importance. Dr. Shalonda Horton is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Texas School of Nursing. Her diverse nursing experience covers public health, oncology, medical, surgical, outpatient surgery, post-anesthesia care, and inpatient psychology. Shalonda, we are so glad that you could join us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So the word that we're going to start with is VAMOS. What is it? And why should people be excited about it?
Thank you for asking. VAMOS stands for Vaccine Administration Mobile Operations, and it is a nurse-led program in which we are getting out into the community. So we know there are barriers for community people trying to get to the hubs for their vaccine, and so we decided we needed to be creative and go to the community.
Okay, so how is VaxNow related?
Well, Vaxnown is related to Vamos in that the Vamos nurse team runs Vaxnown. And Vaxnown stands for Vaccinate, No Waste. And so when our main hub finishes for the day and they have leftover vaccines, we don't want to waste them. And so our nurses have a standby list of patients that we contact and we meet them to give them their vaccine. And so it's still a mobile part of the vaccine program, but it allows us not to waste vaccines. The other part with VaxNown is it allows us to, in the evening, to also do homebound visits with patients who may have, who are not able-bodied and able to leave their home, so we can go to them and give them their vaccine.
And so how, and so one question that I have, like how the idea for this kind of took shape for either Vamos or VaxNow, and sort of, you know, just how this program was first conceived and put together, if you have any insight into that.
Yeah, I wish I would have took notes on our little napkin, how we started it.
Yeah.
There is some of the faculty, and most of us are public health nursing is our background specialty. We had noticed the barriers of patients and just listening to patient stories that we had encountered, or family members or friends, of how they were having trouble getting to the hub sites. And we were just thinking, well, we need to think creative outside the box. So what do we need to do to get to the people? And so that's where it came from. And some of the stories range from, I don't have transportation. When you think about social determinants of health, I don't have transportation, or there's trust issues. And so we know that, I know there's many people who are part of the village as far as healthcare providers, but sometimes nurses have an ear with the patients that is unique sometimes. And so hearing their stories allowed us to tailor our program ideas to meet their needs. So okay. It's a partnership.
So tell our listeners more about you. I mean, tell us, you know, about your journey from nursing to professor of nursing and maybe some of the high points along the way.
I got into nursing. I originally started off pre-med. I wanted to be a pediatrician. And when I got to Texas Christian University, my parents said, you only have one semester there. We can't afford it. And coming from humble beginnings, we didn't have a lot of mentoring on how do you apply for scholarships? How do you even get into college? And so my roommate was studying nursing, and my best friend was studying nursing. And my best friend was in ROTC. And she said, hey, the Army needs Army nurses. And she said, you could stay here at Texas Christian University if you get a scholarship with the Army. And so I said, I'll do it. And so I switched to nursing. And I think that was my way of finding my true calling. And so never thought twice about anything else but nursing. And my military experience has really helped shape me and help me grow as a leader. And so I really appreciate that wealth of knowledge and experience. And that's also helped me in what I do now. And when I was working in the post-anesthesia care unit, I kept wondering, how can I help patients come out of anesthesia a little bit better? And I noticed that it was hard to extubate people who may be overweight or had a history of smoking. And someone said I should consider public health nursing if I'm thinking about health promotion and disease prevention. And so that's why I went back to get my master's at UT School of Nursing, and they had a specialty in public health. And so that got me into public health. And when I graduated, I planned on going to work for Austin Public Health. And my faculty mentor here said, did you think about teaching nursing? And I was like, no, I don't think I should teach. But her just planting that seed made me think about it. And so I started taking some of the teaching courses. And then I said, you know, I really want to be part of the legacy of nursing, the next generation of nurses. And so it's been grateful to have mentors and just life circumstances that actually get you on the right journey, my right journey for me. And so that's how I got into teaching nursing. The next step, I wanted to do program evaluation, doing research, and someone said, you should consider a PhD. So I'm grateful for those mentors in my life. And I knew my GRE scores were about to expire. So I said, let me hurry up, get in the PhD program before they expire. And so I finished my PhD in 2015 and have been part of the School of Nursing since 2006.
Okay. Yeah, and I've always felt that Sometimes you understand a subject better by having to teach it to somebody else. And I would assume that nursing is no different in that respect, right?
That is correct. And you have people learn differently. And so going through it allows you to see different ways to teach a concept. People might get it by hands-on. Some people might be visual learners. So it actually has helped me. It actually pushes me to be a better faculty professor, to help reach students where they are. So we can, one of my teaching philosophies, well, part of it is iron sharpens iron. So as I'm sharpening the student to, you know, be the best that they want to be, they're helping me to be the best that I want to be.
Sure, sure. So what have you learned about reaching people with, I mean, like you mentioned, the trust issues. What have you learned about reaching people with pro-vaccine messages since you've began doing this work?
Number one thing is relationship. And when we first started VAMOS, we picked two of our community partners that we already had established relationships with. And they were two African-American churches in the east side of Austin, And we already had partnerships with them through the AMAN program. And we already had some of our students placed at their site for their clinical rotations. So I think that relationship over time really helped us to get in the door saying, hey, may we come and partner with you to vaccinate your congregation. So relationship building is huge when you think about trust.
Okay. And so, yeah, one question that I've got is if you're trying to establish relationship, you know, what are some signs that you look for in another person that your message is starting to break through?
I'll try to answer it and then you can tell me if I didn't.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the signs is if you have a trusting relationship, that there's follow through. You know that the person's going to carry out what they said they're going to do. And it's not just showing up when I need something. It's showing up when my partner, my community partner, wants me to participate in whatever community outreach, and not necessarily because of something I want to do as a community outreach effort. So follow through on my end is important. I think that continues to let them know that I am committed and I'm invested. And I want to say that the School of Nursing, that VAMOS and VaxNOW is committed. And one of the questions that came up is, how long is this going to last? And our dean said she didn't want to start something and then we disappear, when the community still would have a need for vaccines or would still want to partner with this. So we said as long as it would take is how we would. So we're in it for the long haul. So that's part of a relationship that it evolves over time. And so I would say follow through on what you said you're going to do is a sign of a healthy relationship.
Okay. Yeah, that makes me think of lately we have been having discussions about Brené Brown, her Anatomy of Trust. It's a recent TED Talk that she gave, and she uses an acronym to define the core elements of trust. The letters spell out the word braving. Let's see, and the second and third letters R and A are reliability and accountability. It's kind of, you know, two of the seven pillars of trust in Brené Brown's estimation. And so that's what you said made me think of. So that really pinged for me. So I do appreciate that.
I agree with that. And yeah, even with we did three pilot VAMOS events because we wanted to see so we could evaluate and do process improvement. And one of them related to accountability, the community partner shared that, they shared that there are some things that we could do better. And so it's one thing to say, do the vaccines, but if you don't listen to the partner to improve, we were grateful for their feedback. So that way, the next event, we did better. And then we listened to the next community partner and improve. So I agree with that. Accountability is you have to listen and then you have to receive feedback. And then what do you do with that feedback?
Right. Yeah. And so the older I get, the more necessary I occasionally find it to test my memory. So I'm going to see if I can remember all the letters of braving. B is for boundaries. R is for reliability. A is for accountability. V is for the vault, as in, you know, keeping people's confidences. I is for integrity. N is for non-judgment. And G is for generosity. If any of my listeners are curious, just look up Brené Brown, Anatomy of Trust, and you can find a lot more about this. And maybe even the Hawk Foundation will have more to say about this. Anyway, so thank you for indulging me on that little side journey there.
No, it's not a sad journey. Yeah. It's fitting. The communities, we're being vulnerable. We're going into their space, and they're allowing us in their space. And that shared space is how where we get to work together as a village. So yeah. I appreciate you bringing that in there.
What are the most common questions that people have for you about the vaccine? And how do you respond?
One of the big ones is lack of knowledge. So I really appreciate how our community partners have come alongside and helping to share information. But one of them is the virus in the vaccine? Will it cause COVID-19? And I share with them that, no, the virus is not in the vaccine, because sometimes they may listen to different news outlets that are not sharing accurate information, or you're listening to a friend or family member who's sharing information that's not accurate. And so I appreciate those questions, because people want to learn and they're wanting to educate themselves so they can make the best decision for themselves and their family. So I tell them, no, there's not any live virus inside the vaccine. And I explain that at the vaccine, the way it works is, since it's an mRNA, it's a message. It delivers a message to our cells and tells our cells how to create a spike protein on its cell, and then we create antibodies then to fight against that protein. And I think when they start hearing just the word no, and just be very honest and frank that it's not a live virus, I think that helps them. And then I have a little video I found online that I'll share with the different community partners to share with their clients that they serve. And those who are visual learners then also get to see how the vaccine works. The other question I get is related to, didn't they rush this? And I get to explain that the way the vaccine is designed has been studied for years. It's been over 10 years that they've been studying it. So it's not brand new, and they didn't rush the process. They followed the guidelines for the FDA, and it's very strict protocol for their research. So I think that helps, letting people just know it wasn't rushed. They've been studying it for years. The other one is, does it change my DNA? And I tell them, no, it's just a message that's delivered to your cells, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always been my sense that, and it's unfortunate, because so much of the focus, and this is going to relate to my next question, actually, so much of the focus is on the hardcore vaccine resistant, but it seems like there's this much larger number of people who are kind of on the fence, and it's probably more productive, you know, to focus most of your energies toward that latter group, you know? So people who are genuinely curious about whether the development of these was rushed or not. So I think it's really worth reiterating that tends to be the more common kind of vaccine hesitancy, you know, that people encounter.
Right. And I would think another question I get is, are they tracking me? And I even had a provider that saw on the news that the vaccines were being tracked, but they missed the part that talked about is being tracked on the truck. The truck that's delivering the vaccines, because you want to make sure that the temperature change. Are they still maintaining the integrity of the vaccine? And once they're delivered to the site, then the tracking of the vehicle is done, because you had to monitor the temperature. And the provider goes, oh, that makes sense. They did come back and do a recap. That makes sense now. So I think it's just Messaging is really important. And then the community partners, for example, we did an event this past Saturday at Greater Mount Zion Baptist Church. And I really appreciated how they did a panel discussion on a Sunday, and they allowed people to ask questions. And then there was a nurse, myself, and another physician was there. And then they had a congregation member who got the vaccine. And there was a facilitator, and they answered people's questions. And then we did the sign up for the vaccine. And one of the people who showed up to receive her vaccine, she shared that listening to that panel discussion, said, like, she heard, no, there's not a live virus. Yes, it is safe. And she said that was just like, I can do this. I'm going to go ahead and get it now that I really have my answers. And so I like that they took the time and didn't just, hey, sign up. They said, let's educate, answer questions, and then you can sign up. And even on the day of, people got the chance to still ask questions if they wanted more clarity.
So my next question, we're at a point where many of those who want the vaccine have either gotten the shot or soon will, right? And so now there is a lot of hand-wringing about those who remain hesitant to being vaccinated. With so much of the focus on vaccine hesitancy, are there other issues that are at risk of being overlooked, in your opinion?
Yes, and I'm still trying to come up with a better word for hesitancy, because I know there are people who do fall under that definition of hesitant.
So at the foundation, we are starting to use the term vaccine equity.
Yeah. Because I do agree there are some that are hesitant. They're like, no, I'm not sure about it. But I really do think it is an equity issue. I think we really need to start framing it from that lens. I have one patient with the VaxNown that we signed her up for an appointment, and she was for 7 p.m. and she didn't show up. And so we're texting, trying to find her, because we don't want the vaccine to expire, so we need to be able to move on to another patient, but we want to give you a chance to get to your appointment. And then she said, I'm on the bus, I got lost, and I won't be able to make it. And so we signed her up again the next time, and she canceled because she's like, I don't think I'm going to make it there on time. So we finally said, why don't we come to your home? And she's like, you would do that? And I was like, yes. And I didn't tell her that, but our team shared the playing ground isn't level for everyone. And so we have an appointment set up to go to her home next week, Monday. And normally we're finished by like 8:30, but she doesn't get off work till 9 p.m. So we're going to go at 9 p.m. because we realize that life doesn't stop for people, and it's not fair all the way around different groups, if that makes any sense at all. But I think we need to start thinking about equity. Even for the second doses, I know that's been a concern in the news. They're talking about the number of people who haven't received their second doses. And one of our community partners is Cinemark Pflugerville. And what I appreciate about the manager there, when his employees get their vaccine, he schedules them off the next day, because he said, I don't want to risk no shows, but I also want to support that they can get their vaccine. And so we need to do a shift. Employers need to think about, I want to be open. So what policies, what do I need to change in my business so my employees can get the vaccine without feeling penalized or feeling they need to call in sick because they really are not feeling well. And I had one who had just started a job and they canceled their appointment because probation time. And so we canceled their appointment, but we rescheduled to meet them on a day they were off. And so we have, on our end, we're trying to be creative, but I think we also need buy-in from employers and other agencies of how can we create equitable vaccine programs.
So imagine that you are being consulted on the next lavishly funded PR campaign about vaccination. What would you be trying to get across to the campaign planners?
Our team is talking right now about doing a focus group. I think we need to do a focus group to figure out why people are hesitant or what are the barriers, because then I think it would help us with our campaign messaging and tailoring it to different populations. But I would want to tie in trust in there some way. Just with the history of trust with the medical system, whether you're a person who has brown skin, there's a history of abuse. So how do you talk about still trust me? And that question came up during the panel at one of the churches. And they said, with the history of how African Americans have been treated, what do you say to someone who's not wanting to receive the vaccine? And I tell them that, yeah, Dr. Colbert, she was one of the leading researchers who helped with the development of the vaccine, and she's African American. So it's nice to have someone brown on the team. So we need to think about how do you, with our messaging, to answer those kind of questions related to trust. So I think trust needs to be part of it, and being transparent and starting early with, I don't know the details or the pieces that need to be in the message, but I think it needs to start early and over till people get nauseated and don't want to hear it anymore in a good way. But the pandemic has made communicating things harder. So I think the more you put it out there, it helps people get what they need to hear.
Dr. Shalonda Horton, as a communications professional, it's my conviction that we need as many great and persuasive voices talking about this that we can find. So we really appreciate you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. And when you think about voices, I think we should pull in the people who got the vaccine.
Absolutely.
Bring them in and they get to share their stories, like little personal testimonies. I think those should be tied into it.
I think that's an excellent idea for a follow-up. Thanks and take care.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
As easy as it is to judge people for their most outrageous misconceptions about the vaccine and indeed COVID in general, it's worth remembering something, that this stuff can be confusing. If you ask me, the real problem throughout the pandemic has been not so much the lies, but the truths. By that I mean the half-truths, the partial truths, the contingent truths, the things that are true for some people but not others, the things that experts consider true one week but not the next, the things that might be more or less true for you as the surrounding circumstances change. While there may be some whose minds are forever made up, there's probably a much larger number of unvaccinated people who are keeping an open mind and can still be reached. Anything that might make that easier, that might make the vaccine less exotic, more comprehensible, would be welcome. So in this spirit of kinder, gentler vaccine education, I give you the Vaccine Curiosity Project, a collaboration between Chelsea Brass, a doctoral student in communication studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and Melanie Connolly, a medical illustrator, 3D animator, and marketing director for the Austin Healthcare Council. The project features 8 short videos that use animations and voiceovers to explain how the vaccine works in a digestible format. Here's a sample from the first video that's been released.
Your DNA contains the instructions to make mRNA, and your mRNA then makes the proteins that help your cells work. The mRNA only lasts a few hours, like a recipe card that then disappears. This process only goes one direction. mRNA cannot make or change DNA. Some coronavirus vaccines contain mRNA, and the mRNA tells your cells to make a coronavirus spike protein. This way, if you ever come in contact with the virus, your immune system cells can find and recognize a piece of the coronavirus.
The masterminds behind the Vaccine Curiosity Project are here with us to talk about this exciting project and the difference they hope to make with it. Chelsea Brass, Melanie Colony, it is so great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Chelsea, perhaps you could tell us about the impetus for the Vaccine Curiosity Project and how it is that your prior research interests led you to it.
Sure. Well, I study health and interpersonal communication. So it's a pretty cool blend of a program where I'm being trained both in patient-provider interactions, but then also how people talk to each other just as humans. You know, so I study areas that are similar to health psychology. We have an area in health communication called stress and coping. And so I come to it with that kind of training. And I was noticing when the pandemic hit and we were thinking about vaccines, that people that would normally take vaccines were uncertain and they didn't seem to know why. It was this kind of generalized anxiety with a lot of uncertainty that seemed quite overwhelming. And so it was like, it couldn't be articulated which part of the vaccine really concerned them. And there was so much, not even just misinformation and disinformation out there, but also a lot of information, a whole mass of information to have to sift through. And so if you're not someone who watches the news regularly or tracks these kind of issues, it may just seem like a lot coming at you at once. And so that was kind of the impetus. And then I was talking to other stakeholders I've worked in the past, like Jill Ramirez at the Latino Healthcare Forum. And when we were talking about vaccine hesitancy issues, she was the one that kind of flagged it for at least the Latino community as a kind of mental health issue, because, you know, the vaccines are part of a broader uncertainty about COVID-19, and COVID-19 kind of poses itself as a threat. And so there's a lot of uncertainty around that. So we're kind of trying to meet the audience where they're at and not throw too much information at them, but more tailor it to their needs for information and curate an experience based off of the polling figures that we're seeing.
Okay. This question is for either of you. Could you explain the tool's major features and how they were chosen?
So the goal that we had in mind was we wanted to have some animations that were really easily digestible. And we did a bunch of research. Chelsea especially did a ton of research on where people kind of having some trip ups as they're coming across this information and all of the just this massive information. And we kind of boiled it down to several different themes. What are the problems that people are having when they're trying to understand what the COVID vaccines do, how they work, how they were created? And so then we would take one of those problems and say, okay, how do we answer this? Let's do a bunch of research, check with the CDC, check with WHO. How is this actually done? And then how can we make this into a short, digestible animation with a voiceover that kind of addresses the problem really quickly and potentially uses a metaphor to help get that answer across?
I think that Melanie really described it well. I think that her skill set is what really brings this to life. You know, she addresses accessibility issues like creating high contrast colors for those with that have issues with colors, like interpreting colors. So she thinks about those kind of things and she uses her specialized skill set for that. So, you know, I bring the content in based off of the research, but I think that that's what really makes this project unique.
So one question that comes to mind is, so in my intro for the episode, you know, I try to tease out this distinction between vaccine hesitancy and I guess, yeah, vaccine curiosity, for lack of a better term. And so I guess I was just wondering exactly how strategic that the use of the word curiosity is and kind of the load bearing that it seems to be doing. It seems pretty intentional to me.
Yes. So we were very intentional in how we thought about this project, because there's a lot of language out there about kind of myth busting and misconceptions. And Melanie and I had many conversations about how, you know, you're kind of communicating to the audience like that you're wrong. You know, and people have valid concerns. And what we're seeing from polling figures is that some top concerns are just practical ones, like I'm afraid I'm going to miss work from the vaccine, right? And we are not getting, there's not enough messages getting out there that, like, you know, you're likely to feel bad second day, second dose, or like depending on the vaccine that you received. So like there is actual just information needs out there, practical ones. And so we were kind of wanting to try to kind of address that. So we were thinking about positive ways to make it more positive and giving like more of the benefit of the doubt and validating concerns. Because there is a history of issues with vaccines and with certain populations. So we're trying to be very kind of inclusive in how we message this so that we could be the most understanding about this. At the same time, to your point on vaccine curiosity, this is kind of like meant to be an antidote for fear, which, you know, there is a lot that like knowledge and curiosity can help with that, right? We want people to not feel overwhelmed, but more kind of give them buckets of like, is your concern this? Is your concern this? So they can start to articulate on their own and hopefully give them something interesting to engage with. We're hoping to kind of provoke their own innate curiosity to learn more if we can give them something they haven't thought of before. So that's kind of what kind of keeps us focused and inspired around a curiosity model to keep it positive.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And part of it that I saw too, especially when we were researching different types of visuals that existed and graphics that currently exist for, and it's a lot of myth versus fact. And it has a very, you know, you should feel bad if you believe this thing type thing. And that's not the case. It's people have completely valid concerns that they're coming to through forethought, and they're not just blatantly making these sudden generalizations. They're looking at the research and they're looking at the information that they're getting, but they may not necessarily come to the same conclusion as everybody else, or as everybody who's working on the vaccines, or as everybody who does have a level of trust. And so we all have, you know, people in our friends and family circles that are extremely intelligent individuals who have hesitancy for different reasons. And so we try to instead come at it thinking about them, thinking about what is it that they're kind of tripping up on, and where can we try to tease out those little areas that are just becoming snags for people to fully understand where the safety is, where the potential issues are, and things like that, without having that super aggressive type feeling. I mean, even so, I used to work at the Children's Hospital and at Dell Children's, mm-hmm. and I was in pre and post surgical. And I found that if we treated kids like the little scientists that they are, you know, they're constantly picking things up and looking at what's under them and trying to figure things out. If we kind of played to their innate curiosity, they were much more comfortable with the procedure. It was when that information was hidden, or they were, or they just didn't feel comfortable with it, that they were much more scared of what was about to happen. And so I tried to kind of take that same feeling all the way through this too. How do we really appeal to innate curiosity?
Also, I would also add from this, like what she's saying is that I want to be clear too, from like a meta perspective, that we're also kind of, you know, looking to change the hearts and minds of public health professionals as well. So they're not, you know, just seeing this as like a catharsis, or like just getting so frustrated with this issue, and say there are good reasons for this. And so we want to be able to address that.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Melanie, let's go back to your involvement with the project. So you're a professional medical illustrator. And why was your participation so key?
I got really lucky in that Chelsea asked on a forum that we're both on, an email forum for the Center of Health Communications, if anybody was interested in creating a tool for COVID vaccine hesitancy. And I'm currently pregnant. And so at the time that she asked, we weren't really sure, would pregnant women be able to get the vaccine? Would breastfeeding women be able to get the vaccine? And so I was potentially looking down this path of, it might be 2 years before I can safely get the vaccine. And so I'm really going to have to rely on herd immunity. I also have Crohn's disease, you know, an autoimmune disorder, and I take an immunosuppressant for that. So I had a couple particular, you know, just personal reasons to try to encourage other people to be willing to get the vaccine if they feel safe doing so. But also being a medical illustrator, I really enjoy tackling what are the areas that people are having a bunch of misinformation about, and how can we try to look at our audience, figure out how they learn best, and then figure out how we can try to make something that's as clear and concise as possible without all the extra information, with all that excess cognitive load, so that we're really being direct and answering the question as much as possible. And I thought this was a really, you know, both timely, but also really interesting visual problem to try to attack. And so when we first started talking, we were saying, okay, do we want graphics? Do we want animations? Do we need voiceover? Do we want GIFs? What are things that can be readily shareable? And so we kind of stuck with a mix of animations with a voiceover, and then also quick GIFs that can just be shared on social media. And then going from there, we wanted to make sure that we have that content really, really bucketed appropriately so that people don't necessarily feel like they have to go through one module and then the next and then the next. Going back to being a medical illustrator, it's a super fun job if nobody's ever heard of it. There are 4 programs for graduate school in the US and Canada. And I'm always happy to talk to people about it, but we start off our semester, you know, taking a cadaver lab with the medical students. And then after that, we start to branch off into pharmacology, 3D animation, molecular visualization. Some get into AR, VR, haptics, MR. There's a lot of really cool stuff that people can do in this field.
Okay. Next question is for either of you. What are your ambitions for this project, or what is the ultimate scope?
I'm hoping that this can help with self-guided learning. I'm a community organizer by trade at the beginning of my career, and I think it's really important to build consensus around these issues. And so we have to meet the participants where they're at. We want people to be lifelong vaccine, you know, people who receive vaccines. We're gonna be reliant on people to go back for boosters. So this is a long game. You know, we want, you know, people to kind of, you know, be in the driver's seat of their own health education. And it's on us as professionals to tailor communication to meet them where they're at so that they can get the information they need. Because if they don't know where to look and they don't have those materials provided to them, then they kind of have to take a leap of faith on scientists and government agencies. And so we, you know, that's the part of the curiosity as well. So this is kind of almost like a motivational interviewing model where, you know, we want to kind of meet people where they are, make an assumption that, you know, we may not be able to change minds overnight. And so that's actually not the entire goal of this project. This outcome is to help alleviate uncertainty. And we're hoping that that will make somebody feel more empowered to make their own decision so that they can stick with that and have that efficacy and agency so that in the future, they know the reasons why they want to go and get more vaccines when necessary. But, you know, to be able to meet them where they are and kind of try to incrementally move towards that decision is for them. And so that's part of the kind of philosophies and research behind this. So, you know, I'm hoping that this is a decision-making model that can be used more in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, when we started this, yes, it was out of COVID and the vaccines that came out from the pandemic. But at the same time, we made the modules somewhat disease agnostic so that as we're potentially, you know, down the road looking at future pandemics, which will occur, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about how pandemics can occur and what we can do as a population, where we can make sure that there is investment in trying trying to identify future pandemic diseases, you know, so that we can get ahead of them in terms of the research and not be acting in a reactionary manner, you know, things to get people involved and also try to attack it ahead of time.
What metrics are you going to be looking at, to ascertain the impact that this project has had?
Yes, thank you. That's actually really great, because this is like what I really care about with research is uncertainty management, right? We can't always reduce our uncertainty, just like we can't completely eliminate risk from these kind of vaccines. It's more about risk management, uncertainty management, right? So how can we help people with like using learning, their own self-guided learning, to be able to help with reducing uncertainty, but really managing it. And so the metrics that I'm using is related to, I'm going to ask them at the beginning of the survey and the end of the survey. Our modules will be in the middle, and it's still in development. We're kind of at video, between videos 3 and 4 right now, or those modules. But it will, when we release it, it will have a survey at the beginning asking them how uncertain they are about mRNA vaccines, how uncertainty they are about general vaccines. And then we will ask them afterwards the same question. And so we'll have that kind of on a scale. And if we can help kind of move the needle, then we can also tell the professional community, you know, this is incremental. This is something that some people just need help with over time. And so, you know, that's part of the reason why those metrics were selected, but also because we do actually want this to be, I don't want to say therapeutic intervention because we're not clinicians, but like therapeutic in the sense of like helping, like really from a mental health perspective, like how can we just help them ease their anxiety from the uncertainties around this?
And this could also definitely be a tool that's used by physicians. Most of the research that I was seeing, that Chelsea was seeing, was saying that one of the most important things for people in order to alleviate their uncertainty is if their doctor were to say, yeah, I got the vaccine, I would recommend getting it. And it's their personal doctor that they have a personal relationship with. And so if we can help give those physicians a tool that can then answer further questions and say, hey, you know, check this out and then let's talk about it type thing. It's not meant to be in lieu of any kind of conversation that people would have with their doctors, but it's meant to be a supplement for.
Managing uncertainty, I would think, is pretty crucial to people's overall well-being. And so, you know, as a foundation, you know, we welcome any fresh or penetrating insights into how it is that we can do that. So Chelsea, Melanie, we really do appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today. This sounds really exciting, and I wish you the best of luck with this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Both of the interviews that you just heard, in their own ways, touch on something that is becoming a key area of concern for mental health and well-being, and that is design. In my first interview with Dr. Shalonda Horton, design factored in somewhat indirectly as we were discussing how to literally reach people where they are with information that they need to take care of their health. In the second interview with Chelsea and Melanie about the vaccine outreach project, design was more at the forefront as we talked about what is essentially a technological solution to the problem of uncertainty. But it was back in episode 70, Designing for Mental Health, that we dealt with this topic in the most head-on way. In that conversation, we delved into how good design can transform not just consumer products or physical artifacts, but entire systems. So I want to share with you a clip from that episode.
First of all, I think the simplest thing is to say, I think people always think about design as how it looks, but we like to talk about the fact that design is also how it works. And from that standpoint, design can do much more than just how something looks or feels. It certainly impacts those, but it can do things like simplifying complex problems, you know, reducing friction within a system, improving experiences for people, creating truly engaging experiences. So some of the things that we bring to that are processes that are well-defined that can help really understand the underlying human needs and then really take a set of processes that bring an iterative approach to creating new solutions that help really redesign or manipulate the what surrounds us and how we can think about that differently.
The voice that you just heard was Kat Jones, then with the Design Institute for Health at Dell Medical School. If you'd like to hear more, I have included a link in the episode description, so I hope you check it out. And that does it for this episode. We are so glad that you could join us. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Really good comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. I want to give thanks to my wonderful colleagues, Anna Harris, Julia Sufrin, and Veronica Rodriguez for all of their production assistance. This wouldn't be possible without their help, without the support of my organization, the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by being there for others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, or whichever podcast app you prefer. Thank you so much for joining us.